Hello and welcome to yet another Motor1.com Test Car Happy Hour. This time being joined by our friends over at InsideEVs.com because we're going to talk a lot about EVs today. We've got one dyno juice burner and an exciting one at that. And then we're going to talk about some electric vehicles that we've been driving. And we're going to have a little bit of conversation about what we think the very best EV you can buy under $60,000 is if you happen to have that princely sum. Guys, joining me today, I'm Seth, editor-in-chief. I've got Mr. Brett Evans from sunny SoCal saying hello from outside. I've got Mr. Jeff Perez joining us from sunny, well, not quite South Florida, but Florida anyways. Yep. Say hello, Jeff. And hello. And welcome to all of you. We are going to, as usual, solicit your questions and your feedback as we're chatting. If you guys have anything to say or anything you want to ask of us, please let us know. If you're watching this on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, you can just leave a comment or question right where you are and we'll get it. And if super producer Kyle likes it, he'll throw it up on the screen as he's done with our good friend Gary Clark, who is first in yet again to say, I've put my money where my mouth is on the answer with my first BEV ever purchased less than 30 days ago, the 2023 Ioniq 5 limited all-wheel drive. I skipped the 2022 kinks and still got $7,500 off the MSRP. Gary, first of all, congratulations. Ioniq 5 is a car Yeah, we all love it. We gave it an award. We gave it our Editor's Choice Award, in fact, for the 2022 Star Awards, which is fantastic. I think you're really going to love that car. So that's a great way to kick us off. We're going to hang out until the last to decide what our favorite $60,000 EVs are. But in the meantime, keep those comments rolling. Jeff, let's go to you. We haven't seen you in a minute. You weren't here last week. You have been driving one of the three electric vehicles that we're going to talk about this week, and one that is actually really close to the Kia, yeah? Or one really close to the Hyundai, right?
It is the Kia.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just got done driving the Kia EV6 GT, which I guess is the sibling to the Ioniq 5 and eventually the Ioniq 5N whenever that gets here. But yeah, it's the sportiest EV6, you can get 576 horsepower, which is a lot of power. 545 pound feet, 0 to 60 in 3.4 seconds, which is quicker than the base Taycan and maybe the GTS. Wow. I could be wrong. At least one of the Taycans, and 206 miles of range, which is the only bad number on that list. So
yeah,
it's a really interesting car. I mean, I really loved the standard EV6, and I thought it was more than enough performance for like 75% of people, unless you really want something stupid fast, because the GT is like genuinely supercar quick in a straight line. Like 3.5 seconds, 3.4 seconds is supercar, sports car kind of numbers. I would say the GV60 performance was about as quick. Again, the same platform, same sort of idea. So those two were really surprising, but I like the styling of the EV6 a lot. I think the GT doesn't really go super hard on like the aggressive styling. It's got the bigger wheels. It's got like those, what is it? Acid green. Is that what they call it? Acid green, like brake calipers.
Yeah.
So it's
kind of a
cool
neon green. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a neon green. So I really dig it. I had a really nice time driving this thing. And it's also like I mentioned this in my pros and cons review that went up the other day. Kia actually limits the output depending on what drive mode you're in, and I think that was kind of like a hidden thing. I don't know why they didn't make it super public, but when you're in eco mode, it's only about 200 something horsepower. You really have to go into full GT mode to get all 576 horsepower. But when you're in those lesser modes and you're not totally gunning it all the time, it just feels like a normal EV6. It is super comfortable, super nice to drive. It's got decent cargo space for a small crossover. So it's definitely the top of my list. I mean, we'll talk about this, like you said, later, as far as like what the best EV I think to buy right now. It's near the top of my list.
It is great. I will say that I think that with those, you know, the wheels and other sort of subtle tweaks, the GT looks striking. I mean, this is a really great shape of a vehicle anyways. I think it hits a lot of notes that a lot of us who are car enthusiasts love, because it kind of has that, like you're saying, small crossover, maybe kind of wagon-ish sort of body style. So I've been in an EV6, but only very briefly, and I didn't really get a chance to do a lot of stuff with it. Like I didn't do grocery shopping or anything like that. It's got such a low roof line. Is the cargo area compromised because of the rakishness of the design, or?
A little bit, but it's really not that bad. I think there's a good picture in there, Kyle, of the trunk space. It's got a lot of trunk space for such a small-ish, you know, crossover wagon kind of thing. The roof line is definitely the entry there is definitely a little tight. I think the design sort of cuts in on some of the ingress and egress stuff, but it's pretty good. I mean, in terms of just space, it's not bad.
Yeah, it's not quite to the level of like the, you know, the Mach-E that you're driving right now, Seth. It's not quite to that level, but yeah, no, it's solid. Definitely, definitely like a pretty impressive packaging effort on their part. You know, they got a lot of human and cargo space into a relatively smallish vehicle.
Yeah, and as Kyle put in the chat, he started to show too. Brent, you did a video first drive of the EV6 GT a while ago. Is it a car that still sits with you, still near, again, we don't want to tip our hat too much, but like, is it around the top of your list when you're looking at competitors in this segment right now?
You know, honestly, it's not super high on my list, the GT version at least.
Sure.
If Brandon was here, he would talk a big talk about how performance oriented EVs don't usually like move the needle that far in terms of like their lesser counterparts. Gary was also talking about how, you know, for him, the all-wheel drive thrust is spicy enough. And I kind of tend to agree. I think the EV6 GT line or the Ioniq 5 all-wheel drive are sporty enough. And like they do the job well enough that I don't think going all the way EV6 GT is necessary. And especially since, you know, they don't really like, it's still a heavy car, and they don't really do a ton to the suspension to make it really dynamic and exciting to drive. Unless you're kind of just pinning the throttle everywhere you go, which is great. And Jeff's absolutely right that like it is substantially faster than the regular cars, in a straight line.
Yeah.
And that is thrilling, but
yeah, that's, I mean, I agree with that larger point of like a lot of, not a lot, but there's a good amount of performance EVs that don't really move the needle far enough. And like the performance, the Taycan, I think, is an exception there. And there's a few others, but like the iX M60, Brandon and I both drove that. And we're like, it's not like, it's quicker, but it's not like substantially better that you really need to pay this much money. I think the EV6 GT is way faster than the base version. I think if you really want a much quicker version, then this definitely stands out. I think it's 250 plus horsepower more than the standard one, which is actually a lot when you really look at it. So I think
it's a ton more power. You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, but you're right. The handling isn't like substantially better. The adaptive suspension is pretty good, but it's still like a pretty big, heavy kind of feeling car when you toss it around. It kind of understeers a lot, but I think it's, if you really want straight line speed, if that's what you like, then it's worth upgrading here.
And do you know, like, what's the sticker on yours, Jeff? And do you know off the top of your head, like, what the price delta is between kind of the next step down or the top of the EV6 range?
So the sticker on mine was just over 60. It was close to 63.
Sure.
So, and that's about the base price for this trim. There's really not a lot of options on the GT, that everything comes standard. Mm-hmm. And that's like a, let's see, it's like almost a $12,000, $13,000 Gulf compared to the base version.
Once you get all-wheel drive, though, you're closing that gap to more like $6,000 or $7,000. And then, you know, the EV6 is a little bit, the GT is a little bit lacking in like some of the luxury features. You know, you don't get heated, you don't get ventilated seats. I can't remember if you do get heated seats or not.
You do.
It's still like an incredible, you know, performance bargain for sure. The biggest like downfall for me on the GT versus the rest of the lineup is the range. You know, like if it's not going to like blow my skirt up every time I throw it in a corner, I would probably rather just have 250 miles of range instead of
taking the range.
But it is brilliantly fast. So
206 miles is like really not great, especially when you compare it to like the Mach-E GT. Which I wrote it in my review here. I don't remember how much the Mach-E and like the Model
275 or something like that. Yeah. I have it.
So you're sacrificing a lot of range there. And Kyle, I have a picture there's a larger story that I'm going to do, and I brought this up a while ago of where charging ports should go on a car. And the one on the EV6 and the Ioniq, the Ioniq has the one on the back too, or is it in a different spot? It just annoyed me. I know that I've been to a lot of charging locations for Electrify America that have it just like directly behind the spot, so you just back in. But the ones near me, for whatever reason, they're all sideways, like a gas pump. And so trying to get the cord around there to that little port there in the corner, there's a picture of it plugged in, Kyle. It's at the bottom of the folder I sent you. It's just impossible. It was so hard for me to get that thing plugged in based on, you know, the limited charging spots that were available, you know, to the two or three different chargers I went to.
And it didn't make it better if you backed in or nosed in either way?
No, it didn't matter, because I did back in at the one that was so I was backing in and the charging port's on the right side and the charging station's on the left side. And if I pulled in, it was too far because the charging cord was on the other side and I'd have to wrap it around. It was a whole mess. It was a whole thing. But yeah, that was my one like big pet peeve.
Real quick, backing up, because I want to make sure that we got it right, because of course we've got Gary, and then hello and welcome Mach-E Vlog are correcting us, my guesstimate, and saying 260 miles of range for the Mustang Mach-E GT PE and 270 for the regular Mach-E GT. So we were close, but not right. I just want to say too, like, this is something that I'm starting to experience. Recently moved. I'm next to about 2.5 blocks away from a parking garage that has charging for free if you're parking there, which is fantastic. But we're in, you know, a parking deck, so the spaces are angled and tightly put together. And one thing that I'd never really considered, because usually I was doing charging at outdoor charging places, was the car sort of becomes a piece in a puzzle in that way. And if the cord isn't quite long enough, if it doesn't extend enough, you are having to like maybe switch around to know exactly where the charging ports are, back in, nose in, depending on the particular car. And it'll make an interesting point of comparison for these. So. It's kind of great.
I wonder why more electric cars don't do, because like the Taycan has one on both sides of the front fender, both front fenders. Yeah. I don't know why that isn't more common. And to that end, like gas filler necks too. Like, it doesn't seem that difficult to just have two filler necks or two charge ports. So I feel like that should be more common. MJ42 Kramer asked how people felt about the Niro and Kona having them on the front. And I think that's great.
Brilliant.
In this instance that Jeff's describing, where but I actually had a hard time. I drove the Niro and the Kona both a couple of weeks ago, and I had a hard time with my charging situation, you know, getting the Niro in the space and wrapping the like sideways charger around to the front of the car. So I don't know, it's just kind of like, I feel like unless there's a standard, it's going to be one half dozen of another.
There's got to be a standard at some point. Even Electrify America is inconsistent, and I think that's just a result of the parking lots or wherever they're trying to put it, that they have to sort of cater to the layout there. But like, it's just frustrating sometimes, especially with the Kia stuff and the Hyundai stuff, where they sort of put them on the front or back. And it's like, you know, unless you have that back in or straight in charger, then it's kind of a pain.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're limited by the kind of geography of the specific site. You're limited by, again, like what kind of facility you're in. And then obviously, like, sometimes you're limited by like how willing you are to have a cord maybe stretching over the corner, one corner or the other of your car too, which, you know, some of us might have a very low tolerance for that sort of thing, and other people might have no problem with it whatsoever. So very interesting. Yeah, I agree. Like, standardization will help a lot here. Why don't we pivot quickly, Brett? I want to get to the Alpha sooner rather than later, because we're going to be talking a lot of EVs. But let's chat quickly about the Mach-E GT as well, because it's already come up a lot. Like, it's clearly a car that competes with the EV6 GT as well, and a car that I had it last week. Actually, I have a new EV in my driveway right now, so I'm going back to back on this. But first and foremost, like, zoom out, big picture. Brett, you kind of mentioned it when we were talking about cargo space in the EV GT. I forget when I see these on the road. I've been in a couple of Mach-E's before, but I forget the actual interior, the size of this car, and the interior space afforded by this car. Right, it is a very practical You know, like again, like small to almost medium-sized crossover thing that just happens to be squashed a little bit lower. For instance, again, I'm sure that I've mentioned this on this podcast before, but my wife drives a 16 Audi Q5, and she always has car seats in the back, and we do a lot of our running around town. She certainly does all of it in that car, getting groceries, small errands and stuff. This car has way more space. Like with car seats installed, they weren't in this when I did this walk around, but with car seats installed, I don't really have to move the front seats all that much to fit. There's tons of cargo space. So this is actually a really practical, now it's not as practical a form factor as it would be if it were raised up to the level of a full SUV or crossover for sure. But you do have a lot of options for putting people and stuff in this car, which is fantastic. So that's every Mach-E. I think that the other thing that I was reminded of driving this is just like, I don't know about you guys, but I am still really enamored of Ford's, as you're seeing now, the screen and infotainment system here. Beautiful to look at, clear, bright, fast and responsive, easy to use. I still think the little screen inside of the knob, the multifunctional knob, is a cool party trick. And I have zero issues hooking up to this thing, mirroring my phone, like all that kind of stuff, I think is fantastic. Using the baked in software is good too. So, I'll stop there. Am I alone in my general love of the Mach-E overall as a platform?
I love the Mach-E. I think the Mach-E is awesome. I haven't driven the GT, but I can only imagine that extra sort of performance just makes it that much better. The only thing, I think the screen is cool. I'm not a big fan of the vertical screens, usually just a preference, but like, mm-hmm. I think there's a little bit of clutteredness on the newer Ford infotainment systems. I think they need to clean up like the graphics and the segmentation a little bit, because like trying to look at some certain things while you're driving, it's like hard to see exactly what's going on. Everything's super bright and sort of all together.
I love that they kind of are like choosing to keep the driver display pretty minimal on that. Like it gives you so much more like forward visibility, for example, you know, like you're not looking around a massive like monolithic tablet, which I like. I kind of agree with Jeff. I don't love the like vertical. I think Sync 4 is awesome in a like the 12.3 inch display and the F-150, I think is great. I don't think the vertical display does it quite as well. But I love the Mach-E and the GT specifically. I love the spec that you have with the like flower petal wheels. I think they look so good. I love it.
Beautiful, beautiful. And like, so, you know, we touched on it a little bit already. Like the GT is crazy powerful. We're talking about 480 horsepower and 660 some roughly, you know, pound feet of torque given driving conditions. Incredibly fast, right? You know, you've got a good amount of range at that 260 or 270 mile range amount. So really it's bringing a lot of stuff together. I love, like, it's fun to have, you know, the sort of like giggle machine feeling when you've got it in aggressive drive mode and you're accelerating really quickly. It is absolutely, you know, like, again, 10 years ago would have been the fastest thing I'd ever driven or thereabouts. But I don't know, like, as a purchase decision, that it's something that I can like it. Ford's not giving me quite enough, even with all that performance, to justify charging more money for it, considering the base car is so good and so such a good, like, well-rounded vehicle. So I'll say this time versus the last one, I got, as I'm looking at it, like, I got a little bit more used to the button open doors, especially with the little handle on the front. I still don't love those. They still feel a little bit finicky to me. Not that they don't work. It's just like you really have to aim your thumb to be able to get them. And I think it's sort of a solution in search of a problem in my mind, I guess.
That's how I feel. 100%.
Yeah, it's better with the ledge that you can grab somehow at the same time, because I don't have to really think as much. I can just plant my hand there and then hit the button with my finger and my thumb. But we're really like nitpicking at this point. At that point, like, if it's a car that you like and you really want to splurge on it, or you kind of want to show up your neighbor or something like that, is in my neck of the woods. I'm actually seeing quite a lot of these around, being in Southeast Michigan. There are a lot of people who work for Ford, certainly, and maybe more of a hometown vibe on one of these. But I really, really enjoyed my week in this car for sure. I will say that, again, going back to that, because we're still working on the new place and getting home charging installed over here on the public charging solution, where we've got this sort of dinky, they're like 6.5 kilowatt chargers or something like that. This is, I believe it's a 91 kilowatt hour battery pack on here. Man, that thing takes a long time when you've got it plugged in. Thankfully, it's very cheap for me to be able to charge it up. But it takes a long time. It's a big investment in not having the car to be able to get it back up to, you know, 70-80% or somewhere where you'd like to have it for the week.
What is the max charging rate? Oh, go ahead, Brett.
I was going to ask, can you park overnight at that spot where you?
Yeah,
where
that the hack is, and this is what I think I'm going to be find myself doing until I get something in my garage. But you can, all the garages are totally free and open on Sundays, right? So I could park it overnight on a Saturday and walk home, and just get it out of the garage for free on Sunday. So I could get easily 12 hours of charge. I can charge anything basically at that point. So it's no problem if I'm willing to walk three blocks. So
I was going to say 150 kilowatt DC fast charging for this, right?
Yeah.
That's the only good thing. I mean, I know the Kia has like way less range, but it does have 240 kilowatt DC fast charging, which is pretty good. And it was one of the quicker, like plug it in and be done in 30 minutes, 20 minutes and not have to sit around. It was one of the few cars that actually almost came close. I know the stations are like finicky, but it was fast.
We should get like a slightly longer term review of both of these cars and see in a given like 3 week period how much the extra range of the Mach-E compensates for the slower charging. Like see, like in 3 weeks I spent really 219 minutes of the charger instead of, you know, X, Y, and Z, something like that.
Well, somebody, so Mach-E vlog again brings it up. He's saying that, like, you know, in practicality, maybe the max charge rate is actually something like 166 kilowatt hours, right? Like that's not unusual. We've seen that before in sort of testing. Our good friend Tom Malogny has obviously got a lot of experience with this. Like sometimes the vehicles underperform or overperform what the spec is in terms of the charge rate. So a lot of it might have to do, like I'm talking about my personal situation, but obviously my personal situation dictates like maybe what decision I would make too, right? So if you're close, if Jeff also has a public charging solution that's 150, that's, you know, like a fast charger around the block, you might be able to get by a lot more easily with the Kia, for instance, at a faster charging rate and smaller range, right? These things become really personal. Sorry, Kyle, I was talking and I did not. Oh, you got the Mach-E comment up there. I missed what we're going for. So overall, like I said, very pleased with this one. I think it's a great all-rouner. At the end of the day, it hasn't quite done enough to sell me on the GT. Turkus might have mentioned this either in a review or in person at some point, but I will point out that the seats are fantastic. Like the upholstery in this car is fantastic. I still feel like a bus driver every time I'm in it. I cannot, and this is not just the GT, like the GT seats do not solve the seating position issue in the Mach-E for me, which is really high up over the steering wheel. And I just don't dig it.
The performance edition probably would, because I think it gets unique Recaro seats.
I gotcha.
The standard GT seats are literally just Mach-E seats with like Alcantara microfiber trim.
Better trim.
But the GT gets unique Recaros. And that's like the performance edition rather. And that's like the biggest, most compelling reason to go for the performance edition for me. I loved the way the standard GT drove. I thought it was great. I like couldn't find a reason to go for the performance, except those seats are so much better. So
yeah, got it. I'm going to have to get at least one more Mach-E GT.
There you go.
On.
Yeah. You got to experience the light up pony too. You got to,
I know I need that. I didn't notice for the viewers at home, as we were prepping for this podcast, I didn't realize I drove the car at night, but I was never outside of it at night. And I had forgotten that you get the pony that lights up in the front. And I am absolutely a sucker for a light up hood ornament. Call me trashy if you must, but I really, really dig it. So I want another car just to be able to take a photo of that. All right, let's pivot quickly. I want to all of our friends who are here for EVs, especially when we're talking about 60 grand performance EVs, stick around. We're going to take a little break. We're going to pause. We are going to talk about a car that I promise you is very, very new, but uses a slightly older technology insofar as it burns gas. Brett, you were just in Italy. Tell us what you're out there driving.
Yeah, I went out to Italy to do the first drive of the Alfa Romeo Tonale, which in U.S. form is going to come exclusively as an all-wheel drive plug-in hybrid. So that means it gets a 1.3-liter turbocharged four-cylinder in the front with a six-speed automatic transmission. I can't remember the last time I drove a six-speed automatic. And then it has a 15.5 kilowatt-hour battery and a 120-something horsepower electric motor on the rear axle. So total output is 285, 305 combined pound-feet of torque between everything. And I have to say, you know, this is Alfa Romeo's first plug-in hybrid in the U.S., and it is so well-tuned and so well, like, the handoff between electric and gas is really seamless, and they do that plug-in thing really well, where when you romp on the throttle really quickly, the electric motor gets you going, and then once the turbo engine is spooled up and the electric power starts to taper off, it kind of just that transition is really, really both really fun and also really seamless. It doesn't feel like lumpy and surgy like some plug-in hybrids can. So I was so impressed. I kind of was planning on being a little bit disappointed, but I just came away so impressed with how this car drove. And you know, again, you know, it's a front-wheel drive biased platform. You can see there's a ton of front overhang. The engine hangs out pretty far over the front axle. But because of that battery in the center tunnel and then the electric motor on the back, weight distribution is actually pretty good. And it handles really, it's surprisingly like really fun to drive. It's heavy because it's a plug-in hybrid. It's obviously going to be a little bit heavier than most of the competition, but so that affects like the absolute limits of the car. But when you're within those limits, it's so fun. It's just such a delightful little like responsive and fun. And the suspension does a great job of like providing both good handling and a good ride. I was so impressed by the way that it drove, for sure.
Alfa has always gotten that balance of you know, ride comfort and you know, kind of a well-tuned performance suspension really well. That ride handling balance is something that I think is absolutely like in that corporate DNA. Real quick, telephone dial wheels. I mean, you're just killing me. Like immediately.
Oh yeah.
When I see those wheels on any Alfa, I am at least 80% in on it. Right. Like everything
it looks
else.
Great. I think the whole
design, I don't actually
really
think
good.
It looks great. That's funny. I don't I actually find it slightly awkward. Maybe Brett, you just mentioned the nose heaviness of it a little bit. And we were debating sort of different images to lead your first drive of it with. I think it's kind of awkward looking, and I rarely say this, but it actually feels like it needs bigger wheels. Like the stance is a little strange to me, or maybe they just need to be pushed out a bit, but I love the wheels themselves are iconic, or a variant of a very iconic design. Right.
I definitely kind of agree that like the nose heaviness feels a little, it doesn't feel nearly as dynamic as like the Stelvio. The hood is so long, the cabin is pushed so far back in the design. So like it really feels like a very dynamic design. This one, I agree, like it's a little nose heavy, but I think they do a good job of making it look kind of like an angry Chihuahua or an angry pug, just like a funny little thing that isn't going to do any real damage, but it's still just really cute and charming when it's like trying to be a big dog. I think they did a good job with that, at least.
From this angle, it definitely looks more nose heavy than it does in some other angles. But I think compared to the Hornet, which I really dislike visually, I think the Alfa design cues here works so much better than they do on the Dodge. And I think you're right, Seth. There's something weird going on with like the wheels and the wheel wells. Like there's almost too much space, or I don't know what's going on there. But I think as far as small, like kind of luxury crossovers go, none of them are that appealing visually. I think this one is pretty good.
This probably is unfair, and I haven't, like, I'd have to look at pricing and all that to actually compare them. But my mind immediately goes to like E-Pace, right? As like something that like, you know, could have been or may have been, you know, really well done, very attractive, great to drive and things like that, you know, from not a, you know, a legacy brand, but kind of a legacy oddball brand, something that's never been completely mainstream in the US. So I almost want to put Tonale into that category a little bit, fair or unfair, you know?
Yeah, I kind of see that, but it also kind of ticks the same box for me, because the E-Pace is a very front-wheel drive looking vehicle. But it kind of just like it translates the Jaguar design into kind of like a
there's the pug.
There, yeah. Exactly. Loki, the Tonale is Loki in sheet metal for sure.
That's hilarious.
I like it though. I can say the only like real downside I have with the thing is the interior materials are just like, they're a step down from Alfa, and they're definitely a step down from like you know, even like the cheap Mercedes, the cheap GLA or the cheap BMW X1, the like less expensive cars, it feels a little kind of a bummer. And that's such a shame because I feel like part of the Alpha experience is just like this like flood of like leather smell when you get in the car and like, sure. you know, all this like evocative Italian like stereotypes and cliches and stuff like that. And it kind of feels that's where the Dodge-ness, I think, kind of feels a little unfortunate. But
yeah, otherwise... let's talk Hornet for a second, because you guys, like, there was a lot of chatter as this we were editing this review. And Brandon obviously is recently back from driving the Dodge Hornet, which is, for those of you who don't know and haven't seen it, like, not only share a platform. I mean, they're really close, right? Like they're not, you know, I always hesitate to say identical vehicles or badge engineering because I think that stuff happens a lot less. And I have not, again, done the due diligence to know what Elf and Dodge have done to differentiate the things, but they're pretty close from what I'm hearing from the two of you. And apparently close enough that we suspect, though we haven't done any real reporting on this, that there's maybe somewhat of a minor schism inside of Stellantis too regarding the existence of both of the vehicles. Right, exactly. There's a source of some interorganizational beef is what we're seeing now from inside EVs.
There's an anonymous Alfa Romeo source that says that the company was really, the division was really frustrated when Stellantis said that the Dodge Hornet had to like take, because it was, I believe the car was engineered by Alfa Romeo. Mm-hmm. And there's an anonymous source that was talking to some news outlet, and then it got picked up all over the place, that Alfa Romeo was really frustrated that like all of their hard work to build this, you know, their first like really, really truly mainstream American product, something that was going to appeal to a wide variety of people, was going to get cribbed and turned into a, you know, $30,000 to $45,000 Dodge, which is a totally, I mean, it feels fair to me. I will say, like, it feels better as an Alpha. Jeff talked about how it looks better. The front end of it matches the rest of the car a lot better. Doesn't look anonymous at all, like the Hornet kind of does. And I was playing with the configurator, and it's actually not, the price difference isn't, it's not that favorable. If you go for a Hornet with the plug-in hybrid and all the options, the price difference is only about $3,000 or $4,000, which, you know, that might be enough for some people to go for the Alpha, even though like the mechanical changes may not be as drastic, but just having a better badge, having something that feels like it should cost $50,000 instead of, you know, a compact crossover from a mainstream brand.
Feels like, I think we talked about the EV6 and the Ioniq 5, and those are both basically, you know, using the same platform, a lot of the same mechanical stuff. That's not an offensive thing to me. Like Seth said, like so many companies do that all the time, and it's not a bad thing. In this case, though, it feels like the Dodge has like no identity. It's just, it very much feels like it is an Alpha with Dodge, slightly different design. They even use the is this the first time they used the dual like slash marks logo on a Dodge? Am I crazy?
They've done it with trims before. I don't know if they've done it as kind of the leading.
Like as the lead logo. Like it's,
exactly.
Like they didn't make an announcement there that they were like rebranding, or I don't know. It just felt very weird to me. And then now it's kind of disappointing that to hear that the Tonale has like such bad materials inside. Cause yeah, like you want the Alpha sort of premiumness when you get in those.
Well, yeah. So, and this might be like a personal preference. Cause I know a lot of cars in that class have like hard plastic door panels, hard plastic center console. And this one has that too. No getting around that, but you know, it's class competitive. The issue that I had with it materials wise was the dash top was soft. It was like nice, squishy, soft touch plastic, but it was so glossy that it looked like it was just like coated in Armorall, which just felt really like 1998 Pontiac Bonneville to me. And that was kind of a bummer. So I feel like maybe that's a really easy thing to change. You could change that mid year. That wouldn't even need to be like a minor model change. That's a really easy change. So hopefully
get yourself a pack of some really fine grit sandpaper, Brett, and you can take that shine off in an afternoon. No problem.
What I would do is I would just go get like a nice like embroidered dash mat with like my initials all over it. Like
I love
that.
It.
Or I'd go get like the Gucci logo embroidered on my dash mat.
Let's catch up on some comments quickly because I have to read this one from Yuri. Total non sequitur, but I love it. Bring back, we're talking about badge engineering between former Chrysler brands, essentially. Bring back the Plymouth Prowler as an EV. So Yuri, this is a bold move because not only are we reanimating the Plymouth brand, which I don't think is probably in the air anywhere in the Stellantis HQ, But we're also bringing it back as an EV, and we're doing it with a vehicle that, like, not for nothing, was not a successful vehicle. I mean, I know it was like a very small limited production thing, but yeah, I could get behind that. Actually, I think that would probably be something that would bring a lot of energy to the internet.
They just need to base it on the Alfa Romeo 8C.
That's right. Exactly. You've got lightning in a bottle there. And then Retro Cars Forever says, I will say I much prefer the styling of the Tonale versus the Hornet, and also nice shirt, Brett. So we have to see Brett's shirt. Oh, Back to the Future. Yes, of course. Yes, of course. We still have, well, that's a topic for a different podcast and address before. Right on. Okay. So let's talk about the second EV that I was driving in the last 2 weeks. The car that's in my driveway right now, the Volkswagen ID4 Pro S all-wheel drive. So this is my first ID4 loan. This is, I'm starting off with a car that is as good as it gets for ID4, right? And I put this on Twitter. I was and continue to be really interested in driving this car because of all of the kind of current generation of electric vehicles, I would say it's far and away the one that has taken the most criticism, or that I've read and heard the most criticism about, right? Some of it is down to, let me start by saying, I think that as an EV and as a automotive package, as something to just drive around, you know, again, we're talking about sort of a small SUV form factor, roomy for me at 6'5" and a big guy with lots of kids. I think the cargo capacity, I haven't really tried to push it to its max yet, but it feels like it's going to accommodate a lot of stuff. It feels like a vehicle from a size and function standpoint that can 275 miles of range on this one. This has it's the dual motor all wheel drive, so it's got 275 horsepower. It feels plenty peppy. We're talking about the sort of extreme of the mass market electric vehicles. This definitely doesn't meet the same thrill criteria as something like EV6 GT or Mach-E GT, but it's quick, right? So the hard points of it as a normal vehicle, I think are, and as an electric vehicle, I actually think are pretty good. Like this is a car that a lot of people could own and not have a lot of pain points where that stuff is concerned. Where it gets beaten up, and rightly so, is that using it when you're actually behind the steering wheel, as you're seeing me fumble around with right now in this video, man, there is a lot that goes wrong when you are trying to drive this car, right? The steering wheel controls themselves, I don't want to spend too much time beating up on them, because I think they have been beaten up to the point where I was recently out in Spain with Volkswagen and driving a prototype of the ID7, and they they fully admitted that they are retreating from that steering wheel with the touch capacitive controls on the steering wheel, and for good reason. They don't work particularly well. They work. Like, I mean, it's not like I'm 50% of the time they work and 50% of the time they don't. It's like you have to put a lot more thought into using the controls than you do with most other steering wheel controls, especially those with physical buttons, right? And the infotainment, it's not even that, like, on paper, it has everything that I want it to have, right? As wireless CarPlay and Android Auto, as wireless charging. It's really difficult to use. Like, the logic of it is very strange to me. Like, there doesn't seem to be an easy way to get back to home all the time, I guess, which is a strange thing for me. I'm not always positive, like, what I'm getting when I'm stabbing at the controls. And
does that little blue square button stay up when you're using CarPlay, or does it go away?
It goes away.
Yeah. No. Why?
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. It's not always there. And this is another one where I always have to defer a little bit, because we know that it's just as likely that there are issues with my phone as there are with the vehicle. But, like, I got it to connect to CarPlay no problem right off the bat as soon as I got in it. I've been in the car since Monday. Currently, if I walked in it, it would just be a miracle if CarPlay loaded up. I have not gotten CarPlay to reconnect, even though it wants to connect to my phone as a Bluetooth device. It's little stuff like that where, like, I had the Mustang for a week. I drove it about the same amount, did about the same thing in it, you know, sort of school runs and running around town and one kind of fun drive there and back. Had no issues, did not have the same issues at all, like, technology wise. And ultimately, it did what I want a lot of vehicles to do. I want that stuff that's not about driving the car to just fall away. Yeah. I just want to be able to use it and have it not be an issue. And the ID4 is always kind of sticking its nose in, reminding you that you have to do all this stuff to listen to a song, you know, and that's a real bummer.
Well, the problem too is that it is such like a nice, pleasant car to drive. Like, yeah, it's not super sporty or anything, but it is just a really nice, solid electric crossover. And then you get all those like bings and boops and terrible infotainment system. And like, it's just such a mess. And before ID7 came out, I went to LA and I saw the prototype and I talked to the new CEO of Volkswagen America. And he was like very open about how our infotainment is bad, how the software is bad, how we need to fix everything. And I think he's said that, you know, in the past few months of like, they're going to go fix everything. But yeah, that's the biggest problem with this car.
It feels like it's a great mid-cycle facelift away from being a pretty solid machine, because I agree with what you were saying earlier, Seth, about how it just like it drives. It's a lovely little compact crossover. Like anyone coming out of a Tiguan or a CRV or any of those, like they're going to be impressed by the power. They've done some updates to the range in the last couple model years. 275 miles is great, and I think it charges at 150 kilowatts, which is good enough, you know. It's great. And I literally think once they swap out that awful capacitive touch steering wheel and they actually backlight the climate and volume controls, I think it's going to finally be like a very competitive, no qualifications needed, just a good solid SUV.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that they're pretty close with it. I will say, like, you know, again, the ride quality is really good. You're talking about some other crossover, but I went to the why am I blanking on the Golf Wagon? not the Golf Wagon, but the lifted one. All track. Very, very similar experience to me in terms of like, again, just normal driving. I'm not going off-road or anything, but I think that this has the ability to be the right kind of vehicle for a great number of people. But it's not, and just to hit on it too, again, like, because we're maybe fewer people are familiar with it. Like when you've got the dual motor, when you've got, all that power, like it can go from being, spirited, or, you know, from being regular to spirited really quickly, like accelerating through city traffic is easy. Obviously like stuff on the highway is a lot more, kind of painless than you might have with the lower powered car. So they're doing a lot of stuff right. One thing that I do like about ID4, again, having recently been in the upcoming ID7, is, you know, I mentioned this in the first drive of that car, which I drove in prototype form, just to underline that. But they have really gone extremely heavy in using in the information in front of the driver being presented in the HUD, in the heads up display, and not in any kind of like physical screen in front of the steering wheel. And you can see here in ID4, there is a small but really bright, like easy to read screen that has a lot of information that to me is helpful. I get a little nervous making the big bet on the HUD being everything, even though I love the idea of my eyes being up all the time. Of course, when I'm driving the car, there are just so many, there's so much variability in terms of like what's happening with the position of the sun, with what kind of eyewear you're wearing and things like that, where the HUD loses relative to a really nice screen, even a small one like that, that's really discreet and doesn't necessarily do a lot of distracting. So
you said it best. It's a problem. It's a solution in search of a problem, you know, like putting a gauged cluster nice and high on the dash, right in your line of sight, and giving you, you know, enough information to not be distracting, but still be able to, I agree wholeheartedly. I feel like Volkswagen maybe should learn the lesson when they tried to make everything so touch sensitive that technology isn't always the answer. Sometimes the old solutions are the best.
Yeah, agreed. Well, listen, we're reaching. I was just reminded by a meeting reminder that we've got about maybe 15-10 minutes left on this podcast, and I definitely want to talk about our favorite $60,000 EVs to this point. So, if I missed you in comments, forgive me up to this point. But I talked to Brett and Jeff ahead of time too, and I was like, since we're talking kind of about EVs in this space already, if we went out right now, if you guys went out and you had $60,000 to spend on a new electric vehicle, what would be your top choice? And of course, Kyle, you can throw that back up in the chat, but I encourage all of you to weigh in too with what your answers would be. I promise you wouldn't influence us. The judges already know what our answers are. So Brett, why don't we start with you? What's your pick for $60,000 EV?
So this is, I'm not going to say it's the best EV. I'm not going to say that it has the longest range, the best charging, anything like that. I find myself eminently charmed by the XC40 Recharge. Every time I drive one, every time I see one on the road, I just think it's such a lovely little thing. And I had a great time. I had one a couple of years ago for a week. And I love that it's the torquiest vehicle that Volvo offers right now. It has the most torque that you can get in a Volvo, and it's the smallest, you know, smallest body shell that they offer. And I find it so appealing. And you know, now that they've done the model year updates for 24, where you get a little bit more range and a little bit more technology, and there's a rear drive version available if you don't need all wheel drive, it just makes it all the better for me. I think it's a really great, appealing little thing that would fit very well into my lifestyle, and stylish, and it would make me feel cool when I got out of it, you know, kind of just like a little bit sophisticated and a little bit offbeat, which, you know, is the mystique I aspire to. So I love it. I think it's a great little car. And you know, again, it's not the best. It's kind of a dark horse alternative. It's definitely not the best vehicle out there, but I just love it. And I think it's such a charming, wonderful little car.
Super. You basically hit the nail on the head for like Volvo's value proposition for every car they've ever built in the last 60 years, right? Like, not the, other than maybe the safest, but like not necessarily the fastest, best, biggest, most luxurious, but like a really compelling blend of all those things with quirky design, and they kind of go their own way. So I, you know, I've had limited time, but a little bit of time in this car, and I found it exactly very, very charming too. So
I just think they look great too. I think that it's like a really modern telling of Volvo design language. The Recharge components with like a blank grill panel, and it still has a frunk too, which is rare among ICE cars converted into EVs. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it.
Great color palette too from Volvo, always like really interesting but kind of like demure color, paint colors as well, so I love that.
And MJ42 Kramer says Costco has a deal on the XC40 Recharge. Ooh. $2,500 off. You can go get your massive cheese pizza and your XC40 Recharge for $52,510.99.
Do they still have the cheap hot dogs?
They do still have the cheap hot dogs, yes.
Oh, yeah.
MotorOne.com and Inside EVs are not affiliated with Costco in any way, shape, or form. we are not advocating for their deal, but that is, as Lori Allen says, that is interesting for sure. Like, as we put up the page, the Costco page, that's hilarious. Good to know. Good tip, MJ42 Kramer. All right, Jeff, what's your pick?
Well, Brett and I are both going Swedish. Again, maybe not the best, fastest, yes, or best looking EV, but I love the Polestar 2. I can't get over how much I love that car. And this one, this is the new 2024 model, which you can get. And this is exactly how I get it. Black 20-inch, those new 20-inch wheels, rear wheel drive, and then loaded up with the adaptive cruise control, fancy seats, sunroof. And I think it would come in at just like right at 60, maybe just a little bit under, but to me, the dual motor version of that car is awesome. Like, it's super fast, super dynamic, really comfortable. But it's almost like, I think Gary said earlier with the Ioniq 5, like, it's almost too much. You don't need that much. I think 300 horsepower, 0 to 60 in 5.9 seconds, and rear wheel drive is almost perfect for a little car like that. So I think that's my number one right now.
I love the single motor version of this car. Quick story about Polestar 2 and aside. I haven't ridden it yet, but I have in my back pocket a feature that I'm working on about going to Skip Barber's 3-day driving school a couple of weeks ago. And one of the guys that I met there was driving a Polestar 2 dual motor. Sorry, is it just performance? There's another performance package that you can get on top of that too. And interestingly, he's not really a car guy. He's had a couple of EVs, never even thought about taking a track school. He was so compelled after getting his Polestar 2 by the performance of it that he thought, hey, I'd better invest some time into learning how to drive a car that's this quick, and jumped all the way into Skip Barber's 3-day car racing school, which is like, it's a lot. Like, that's a long way to go towards it. Wow. So I thought that was a kind of an interesting story, both vis-a-vis like what Polestar is offering and the performance of the Polestar 2. But also, you know, just how strange and wonderful this automotive enthusiasm thing can, the twists and turns that it can take. So I love this car. I think it's a great choice. It was almost what I picked, Jeff, and then I decided to zag a little instead of my normal zigging with this one. But I'm going like what I guess what would be considered like straight mainstream here, just based on specs and like how I'd use the car. I'm going with the Tesla Model Y Performance at around what, 52, 53 grand. With the performance version of it, I mean, on paper, again, this car is almost unbeatable. 303 miles of range, 3.5 seconds, 0 to 60. It's a great form factor. Like, there are probably a ton of these around you guys where you live as well. Just fantastic, like, practicality in this car. With me, with a small family, I think I could get a lot of use out of this. If it were just me as an individual, I might be tempted to go Model 3 here instead of Model Y, because I like being a little bit lower and I like the form factor of a sedan a little bit more than a small crossover. But there is a reason, and there's a reason that Tesla sells more electric vehicles and more vehicles almost than just about anybody, right? Like, the cars like this, especially with the new price reductions, are incredibly compelling value propositions, especially in the EV space. Tesla is a blue chip brand. Like, listen, there are a million holes that we can poke in Tesla as an automotive company, and certainly in like kind of the ownership proposition over there. But just as a product that you're paying money for to buy and drive, I think that something like Model Y is really in the sweet spot of what people are asking for and kind of require in an EV today. So
I think you're totally right. I have no idea how Tesla does it, but like, it's a Mary Poppins bag inside. There's so much space for the footprint. Yeah. To the point that, so my older brother and his wife were looking for a car to replace. They had a Volvo XC90 and they were going to get a minivan because they needed more space for kids. This was last year when every single minivan was marked up $20,000, and they did the math. They said, we could get a minivan or we could get a pre-owned Model X for the same price. And they went with the Model X, and it's much larger than their XC90 was inside. There's much more space for them for runs to that big box store that we're not allowed to mention anymore. And like, there's, you know, like it's amazing. Like, they were kind of planning on being like, okay, we'll have this for a little while, and then once minivan prices come down, we'll get one. But it fits into their lives so much better than they thought it would, because it's so spacious inside. It's insane.
Yeah. Now, listen, living with one, and again, like, everybody, nobody is going to be surprised to hear this, but it's not like, you know, as inside EVs, it's not like we have a special relationship with Tesla relative to any other automotive outlet. They don't let us borrow cars. Like, if any of us want to drive a Tesla, we have to borrow one, or know somebody who has one, or make, you know, tour one, or buy one, right? Just like anybody listening to this podcast does. So so that, you know, it makes it a little bit, we don't have the same point of view as car reviewers. We don't have the same access to Tesla as we do to other products. So, you know, I definitely get scared off, as many of you do, when I see a couple year old Model 3 or Model S or something sitting in the parking lot with like gaping panel gaps and things like that. That would definitely be something that I would want to dig into and consider a lot more before I actually signed on the dotted line to buy one of these things. But I will say, like, you know, as a very high volume version of a Tesla, as one that, you know, in theory, they should really have locked in. They've been building it for a while. This is probably as safe a bet as you're going to get in that ecosystem. And the stuff under the skin and the packaging is just, that's the magic of why people are so into this brand. So,
man, remember when you could buy a $35,000 Model Y and a $60,000 Model S? prices on these have gone up just crazy, because the Model 3 I really like, but even that is like over, well, 40 to, something.
Yeah, it's down in the 40s now, which, yeah, you know, considering it came out 7 years ago with inflation and all that stuff, like, it's $10,000 in 7 years isn't a crazy egregious price.
Yeah, well, Ford, I mean, I was gonna actually go Lightning, but then I realized that the base Lightning Pro now is 60 grand, and you're like, ooh, yeah, I don't know about that.
Yeah, that's the price increase right there that you got to talk about.
That's why I think that the $60,000 mark is really interesting, right? And it's not, you know, I'm not going to go out and buy a $60,000 car anytime really soon, right? And even as we know, and we talk about a lot, like, average transaction prices are rising. $60,000 becomes sort of more normal, I guess, for people. What it is to me is very interesting, because it cuts you out of, at least currently, of some of the really exciting, you know, brand new brands like Rivian and Lucid. Like, they have yet to compete at that price point. Tesla is obviously there. Some of the legacy brands, like, you know, like existing OEMs like Volkswagen and Kia, Hyundai and Ford are in that space right now, but you can't get into maybe some of the signature products. So it's kind of a bright, or around $60,000 is a kind of a bright dividing line between the stuff that's really special that gets written about and talked a lot and stuff that people might actually consider buying right now, which I think is kind of cool. So guys, thank you so much. Everybody out there, thank you so much for watching and commenting. We really appreciate you. If you happen to be watching this after the fact and you haven't gotten your question or comment in, we'd love to go back through YouTube after the fact and take a look and try and answer some of those. We highly encourage you to come back. First of all, come back next Thursday. We do this every day or every Thursday at 2:30 Eastern time on MotorOne.com and often on InsideEVs.com when we're talking about EVs. You can also subscribe to this as an audio podcast on all the normal audio podcast platforms, iTunes, the Google Play Store, Spotify, iHeartRadio, any of the big ones that you use. We should be on there now, so you can get us there too. Thanks so much for watching. Thanks you guys for joining us. Don't forget to put your comment about your favorite $60,000 or less EV in there so we can take a look, and we'll see you all next week.
Later. Bye, everybody.
See y'all.
Bye.